And now, a personal favourite of mine, stay right here for another instalment from Documentally.
The sounds of the river, the sounds of boats passing and wildlife and a road not too far away, taking you into Rugby Town Centre. It's been a while since I've been here, but when I was here many years ago, I lived here. So it's weird to be on old stomping ground, and I'm here for a specific reason today, not just for nostalgic purposes. I'm here to be educated by the pirate, Glenn Losanto.
Yeah, just one thing. It's not a river, it's a canal.
Oh, great. I've already started with you. I live on a river.
Grasshopper, you have much to learn.
I've failed at the first hurdle. Granted, I haven't got a boat yet of any shape outside of a small canoe. And I've only ever been on the river in that. Today is the first time I've spent any amount of time on the water in a boat outside of ferries. And it's a canal boat, and it's not your first narrowboat.
No, this is the Midnight Star 2. Midnight Star 1 was the first canal boat I ever owned. I've been a canal boat hirer in the past and lusted after owning one for as long as I care to remember. And then finally, 2010, 2011, I managed to scratch up enough money to buy dear little Midnight Star 1. A little tub she was, but a faithful little tub, and we had amazing adventures together. We sailed the Thames all the way to Limehouse, under Tower Bridge. Can you imagine how fabulous that is to go under Tower Bridge under your own steam? We spent nights in the middle of nowhere, nights in the middle of town. We had friends aboard, float my social boat sessions, learning voyages. Yeah, I miss that little boat a bit. But Midnight Star 2 is more sophisticated. She's a more accommodating lady. So I'm very pleased to be aboard her and be her master.
You're not just a pirate by mantle in some way. Not saying you do it for a living. Very, very legal work you do. You have pirate blood in the family.
Yes, apparently the first Losanto in England was brought here in chains because he was a Spanish corsair. Corsair is a privateer or a state-funded pirate working for the Spanish to disrupt British shipping. Unfortunately, he obviously got caught because he ended up in jail in Saltash. And his son, also Philippe Losanto, married a Devonshire milkmaid called Elizabeth Prynn. And we have our family tree going all the way back to Elizabeth and Philippe. 1766 that marriage happened. And it's long been a family story, the family history. And of course with the internet we were able to trace the full family tree. So I know all my relatives going back to Philippe. Unfortunately we can't go back any further because the name Losanto is a anglicised a version of something far more complicated, probably like Santo Domingo Velasquez or something like that, that the Cornish folk thought, sod that, you're Losanto. And actually when you look back through some of the records, it's actually spelt with a Z in some records. It's sometimes spelt Losanto, double barrel. Sometimes it's spelt Losanto with a Z, and sometimes it's Losanto with a single barrel.
So he was working for the government. It wasn't as if he could keep all the spoils for himself.
No, I think that how it worked was the government paid you money to go out and you just did your business. So you were like a civil servant, actually.
Wow.
And your pay was your spoils.
So no maps left in any chests handed down?
No, nothing of the sort. I guess by the time they chucked him in jail, he had nothing but the trousers he stood in.
So, it's in your blood then. How did you first feel, this is right, I need to be on the water?
Well, the strange thing is that when you look back through the family tree, everybody, nearly everybody, is a dockyard worker, a shipwright, a ship's cook, a sailor and stuff like that. But in recent history, we'd become landlubbers. Although my granddad worked in the dockyard and my dad did his apprenticeship at the dockyard, that's a land-based job. But I've always felt the call of the sea. My mother's the same. We've often lived by the sea. And then the sort of the discovery moment was I was sat in a park in London when I was a dispatch rider, a courier, 1987 this would have been. And I sat on a bench eating my lunch, and there were canal boats moored nearby. And one of the canal boat owners invited me aboard to have a cup of tea. She was very nice, and I got to know her quite well. And eventually one day she took me and my girlfriend of the time out for a short hop through Islington Tunnel. And bang, that was it. At that point I knew I had to have a canal boat. Unfortunately, it took me until 2010 to actually buy one. I don't really know what I was doing in the meantime, riding motorcycles, I guess. Then in 2007, I had my sort of final motorcycle moment, which was a sorry I didn't see you moment when somebody pulled out in front of me. And after bodily spearing his car and lying in a pool of my own blood on the road, I thought, do you know what, next time I'm going to get a boat. Ironically, where had I been just before that accident? To a boatyard, where I'd been window shopping for canal boats. So I kind of, you know, what do they say? Be careful what you wish for. Do you know, I believe there's a Spitfire going over. There really is as well.
Cranes his neck.
There is actually a Spitfire or a Hurricane flying overhead.
Oh, it is as well. I think that's actually a Hurricane.
Slightly,
they generally are.
Different wings.
So, you know, be careful what you wish for. I wished for a boat, and the universe delivered me the means to get it because it was the other guy's fault, and I got a massive compensation check, or massive, you know, 20 grand. And I went out and bought Midnight Star 1, who cost me 12 grand. Quite cheap, actually.
Considering what the prices are now, and do prices follow house prices?
They do, to a certain extent, particularly in areas where there's a lot of house price pressure. In fact, when I sold Midnight Star 1, I thought, do you know what, I can get this amount for it in the north and that amount for it in the south. So I advertised it in London, and we sailed it down to London and sold her in London for a substantial premium.
I know, the word substantial premium has been, is the reason why in my own browsing I've had to up the ante somewhat, to use a sailing term. I have no idea what that means, so I'm guessing it was a reward?
I don't know.
Maybe for the head of a pirate.
Possibly.
Who knows? and I'm spending every single penny I have in the world, not kind of realising through your guidance that there'll be many more pennies spent from now on. It's an expensive game, isn't it?
Well, it can be, but you find workarounds. You know, you realise that everything that's got marine written on the packet has got an extra 2 noughts on the price.
So pop accordingly. Quiz.
Yep.
Pop quiz.
Yep.
I'm going to throw things at you. You tell me roughly how much they cost.
Okay,
for
I'll try.
A 55-foot boat.
I'll try.
Okay, gas per month.
In winter, probably £20, £30. In summer, it will take you months to get through that gas.
License?
Mine for a 45-foot boat is, I think, £1,000 a year, roughly. But you do pay by the foot, so yours will be more. My insurance is about £100. I'd say it costs me in the region of £3,000 a year to be a boater.
And you don't moor anywhere full time, do you?
Yes, I do. I pay. Oh. Yeah. I pay for a mooring. I've got full time mooring in the north, but it's in possibly the cheapest mooring place in Britain.
I was going to say, because I've been quoted £3,000 just for the mooring.
Yeah, well, I'd make you jealous if I told you exactly how much I was paying.
You don't make me jealous. Just tell me where it is. I'd drive there.
Yeah, there are no vacancies. In fact, this is the weird thing. For some reason, Cart got it into their mind that they did have a vacancy this summer, and they rented my mooring to somebody else, the bastards. We've been having a little bit of a to and fro about that, because when I went up to just check on my mooring recently in the car, I found somebody else was moored on it. In fact, I'd had a tip-off from a friend on the mooring site. Have you got another boat, Glenn? I didn't think you'd ever buy a plastic one. So I shot up there and had a look and found a interloper. A pirate on my mooring, thinking that it was somebody that was just like, you know, poncing my mooring. I rang up Car and they said, oh, we've made a bit of an error. We've rented your mooring to somebody else. So, yeah. Anyway, they'll be gone by the time I get home in September.
And you'll be getting all the rent.
I wish. They actually refused to refund me, but they are a charity.
Oh, fair. But you don't pay for the time that they were in it, do you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah. I've been basically, well, cart have been being paid rent twice for the same spot. Yeah, it's a bit of a racket. Speak to any boater about cart and you will often get a negative reply. There's a love-hate relationship going on between us and them.
And tell me about boaters as people. A lot of people I've spoken to seem to be characters, is one way. I bumped into a guy the other day who got his first boat full-time at 14 years old. He was an older gentleman now. He was creating all kinds of stuff, like rag rugs and stuff out of rope, and he just seemed to know absolutely everything. Yet since 14 to, he must be late 60s, early 70s now, he was on his, I think, sixth boat.
Yeah, you see, boaters are like people. They come in all shapes and sizes. Some of them are really quite ordinary. You'll get some people who own what we call floating cottages that never leave the mooring. They're just used as a sort of, you know, country home or second home. You get people who live on their boats all year round, liveaboards as they're known, or constant cruisers who move around the country all the time living on their boat. You get posh people on boats, you get hippies on boats, you get ordinary people on boats, you get disgruntled, bad-tempered, curmudgeonly people on boats, and you even get pirates on boats.
What's the percentage of Brexiters to Remainians that you've come across?
It does seem to be slightly on the high side of Brexiteers versus Remainers.
Would that be generational?
Age group. Okay. Yeah, because let's face it, these aren't cheap, as you've worked out yourself. You know, some people are basically living on their boats instead of living in a house, and that can work out cheaper, particularly if you're in London or somewhere like that. But other people have these as a second home or as a toy or as a leisure pursuit. And they may well be in the upper age brackets. I mean, I'll hold my hand up. I am a baby boomer. I was born in 1960. However, I did everything wrong as a kid, so I don't have a pension, I don't have massive equity and stuff like that. So, of course, I voted Remain. But, you know, a lot of my fellow boaters in my age group and older, because you can actually see some remarkably aged people on boats. I've met somebody 87, still living aboard. You know, they may follow the general political demographic, and therefore they may have voted wrongly in the referendum.
Yeah, interesting times. I wonder how things are going to shape out for the boating community, because there's things are constantly changing with the Canals and Rivers Trust as well, isn't it?
Well, the Canals and Rivers Trust used to be British Waterways, and it was denationalised and made into a charity. The idea is that it will become like the National Trust, and you can kind of see the logic behind that, because like the National Trust, they own very historic structures, you know, Anderton Boat Lift, Foxton Lock Flight, Limehouse Basin, etc. You know, they own all these miles of canals. The car actually own these. You know, it used to be a nationalised asset. Prior to that, it was a private asset like the railways. So CART have got this huge responsibility, and an expensive responsibility, to look after this national treasure. And let's get something on record here. This really is a national treasure, because without the canals, we wouldn't be recording this on an iPhone, because without the canals, we wouldn't have had an industrial revolution, because the canals were the transport that enabled the industrial revolution to happen. Because prior to the canals, you moved everything by horse. Well, you can't move China or coal very efficiently by horse, and the first canal was built to move Wedgwood China.
I did not know that.
Yep, Bridgewater Canal.
The tradition playing a really big part in the canal, and yet it is being extended, and you do see boats on the canal with incredibly, they almost haven't changed in some ways. I mean, there are still steamboats here, and I don't see many being pulled by horse, but I'm sure they're out there. Can you be frowned upon for having a canal boat that is a little bit out there?
Well, you might be by the traditional bunch, but I think what's happening now is there's a kind of VW microbus style culture coming into boating with a younger audience, and I really welcome that. In fact, one of my children has bought a boat. By children, they're in their early 20s, but all my kids have got the boating bug. And I'd really like to see the demographic of boating change. I'd really like to see a more funky style. I love the traditional boats, and I wouldn't even mind owning one if it wasn't for the fact that most of them have their exhaust pipes in front of your face. They are fantastic. They're fabulous. I mean, when you say, you know, you see these boats, some of them have actually been on the water since the not the last century, but the previous century. There are many, many boats that have been around for over 100 years and are still in use. Some of them even have their original engines. So the canals are steeped in tradition. But I think also if you look inside a lot of modern boats, they actually look like caravans. So, you know, they have been brought up to date. Here we are sat on Midnight Star 2 with her gas central heating, her flushing toilets and her home cinema.
I know, very impressive. So, how much of the year do you actually spend afloat?
Well, I go out every spring. I'm really lucky that I can work from my boat as long as I've got an internet signal. And the internet signal, even in rural places, has become better and better and better. The data signal. I telework, so this is my office during the summer. I generally leave the home mooring around March and aim to get back by October. One of the reasons why you need to get back by October is not because the weather gets bad, because actually the boats can be quite warm in winter. Something that everybody asks you is, oh, is it cold in winter? To which I reply, yes, if I don't turn the heating on and leave the doors open, just like my house. In fact, if anything, this is warmer in winter than my house because I live in an old Victorian edifice, which is bloody cold in winter. But you need to get back by October because they start the works in October. They have to maintain these canals, and in order to maintain some sections, they've got to drain the water, close the lock, shut bits off. So you get what are called winter stoppages, which you can navigate your way around, or you may get stopped and you may, you know, actually literally not be able to get home. For me to get home, I've got to go up the River Trent. And, you know, if they're going to take one of those locks apart, they're massive ship locks, they're going to take 2 or 3 months to fix them. So the passage may be blocked all winter. So I generally aim to get home before the winter stoppages.
In the years that you've been on the canals, can you list some of the worst bits of it and some of the best bits of it?
Worst bit was when I first got my boat and I was a beginner. And one day I opened the weed hatch, which is a plate in the engine compartment that you pull up in order to get weeds that wrap around your propeller off. Now, little did I know that the weed hatch on Midnight Star 1 was deficient. It was actually below the waterline. So when I took the hatch off, water literally fountained up through the weed hatch. And of course, the pressure of water made it really hard to get the weed hatch back on. And because the boat was quite loaded, so she was low in the water, I had an extra couple of inches put on the weed hatch after that. I very nearly sank her. I can't think of many other bad ones. You know, I've had a few nearly fall. Well, I fell in once, but it was in the middle of summer, so it was quite refreshing. You know, I've had a few people shout at me. You do get a bit of canal rage. Not everybody's happy and cheerful and chilled. But I've definitely had much more good times, brilliant times. I've seen fabulous natural scenes. I've seen a cormorant and an eel have a battle lasting about 5 minutes, where the cormorant was desperately trying to swallow this massive eel, and the eel was desperately trying not to be swallowed. The cormorant actually swallowed the eel 3 times, and each time the eel came back up and eventually escaped. I think the reason why the eel escaped is because the cormorant spotted me taking photographs and got spooked just long enough for the eel to bugger off. So I saved an eel that day. I've met brilliant people, fantastic people. I've had people aboard my boat. We've had great times, really, really fabulous times. And of course, deckhand, my wife and I, we've been having an absolutely brilliant time, even this summer. You know, fabulous, fabulous times aboard. Great, great, great experiences. And of course, the canals go into the cities because they're the old motorways. So one day you are in the middle of nowhere watching a cormorant swallow an eel, and the next day you're at Tesco Dock in Rugby.
And you share quite a lot of these experiences as well. You created years ago the hashtag Slowboat, hashtag Slowboat, should you want to spy on you right now. What brought that? Did you want to curate all of your content in one space?
Yeah, two things really motivated that. One, I'm a sharer. I'm like you. I can't really have experiences without sharing them. It's in my DNA. I'm a former sports journalist, so I'm used to sharing experiences with an audience. The other thing is, actually, Naked Ambition. I realised I had something special out here, so I used it as a branding exercise. We've discussed the fact that I'm the pirate, so I branded myself as the pirate. I was known as the pirate. I'd turn up at a show and people would say, "Ah, it's the pirate." And I used the boat to give me a USP, and it really worked because the boat drew people into my experience. Everybody was out there sharing stuff, sharing conferences, sharing road trips or whatever, but I was sharing something that was slightly unique. And I don't know, it seems to hold a fascination with people. You know, they think that this is a really fabulous life. They're actually right, it is. And I just really enjoy sharing that with people. I don't share it so much on Twitter nowadays. I kind of lost my Twitter mojo. Maybe you can help me get that back. But I Facebook it a lot.
And I think what you're sharing now is this just serenity that we crave because we are not left alone by our devices, by the infinite conversations we've dipped into and keep attempting to pull us back, because the mechanisms of interaction have been designed around that kind of corporate drip fed endorphin that we get with every like and every comment response. And here you are, you will drop something on Instagram or straight into Twitter, and it'll be the sunrise over the roof of your boat while you are at the helm. Is it the helm?
Yes, it is the helm.
I'll let you get that.
No, I'll leave that.
Is that a 70-footer? No.
Yeah, that looks like a 70-foot.
And it's just pulling up outside.
So somebody's trying to moor outside. Wait. We may hear a big bang in a minute.
I love the woman's facial expressions while she's commanding her husband at the back.
The deckhand and captain relationship has definitely failed in that case. So the serenity. Now, this is the interesting thing, that the speed limit for a canal boat is 4 miles an hour. And actually, most boats will struggle to do much more than that anyway. So you're instantly slowed down. You've got the beat of the engine under your feet, a kind of, you know, rhythm. You've got the countryside. But even when you're sailing through the middle of London, the ribbon of water either side of you is a massive insulator. It's really like you've cut yourself off from the hurly-burly of modern life, except for when some scrote on the bank chucks a rock at you or something, which does happen in certain parts of the country, Manchester, etc. So you've always got this sort of like, I'm not with them type feeling going on, you know. I'm detached from that. And I really like that. I used to find that when I was a motorcyclist, that, you know, you'd be on a motorcycle, it kind of moves you out of the mainstream. And you're definitely moved out of the mainstream when you become a boater.
Mainstream being another water-based
yes,
term.
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. In fact, so many terms come from sailing. It's amazing.
And that's what you do on a narrowboat. You sail or you cruise, if it's within context.
Yes.
You pilot a ship, I think.
Yeah, I guess you could say you pilot your boat, but I think you probably pilot a ship. You steer a canal boat. The person standing at the back can be known as a steerer or a helmsman. I think the old boat term, I may be wrong, but I think the old boat term is a steerer. You sometimes see painted on the side of the traditional boats, steerage company or canal steerers or something like that.
A boat's mooring behind us right now. It looks like it's got a radar dome on the roof and it looks shiny, shiny new. Some of these boats can fetch over $100,000, can't they?
Oh, yeah, easy. I mean, some of these boats, what some people disparagingly call the shiny boaters, are really very special. They've been bespoke built. They've got totally glossy paintwork, lots of decoration, beautiful interiors. The radar dome on the front of the boat behind us is, in fact, its satellite, because, you know, they're being quite an old, aged demographic on boats. Some of them haven't realised that you can stream these bloody things.
So, whereas you've got a very small, compact and quite high when it's polled up 4G antenna, some people are dropping dishes on.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Often motorised to track the signal.
And that's TV only. I doubt they're pulling data through there.
They're not pulling data through, no.
There's a surprising number of mobile antennas along the waterways. Why is that?
I think because the waterways follow the railways, or shall we put it the other way around, the railways follow the waterways, because the railway companies started to buy out the canal companies, and they put their railway tracks sometimes actually on the canal bed, but generally alongside. And also because, of course, when they first built the canals, that was the best route, because of the lie of the land or whatever. So you're often, you know, close to these major routes. But also, what I've noticed over the 6-7 years I've been boating, and I've actually been recording data speeds in my map book so that I know where to go to get a good spot, the speeds have just been getting better and better and better. So the whole sort of rural mobile signal thing has been definitely upping its game, which of course helps me be a floating worker.
A floating worker, the ability to change your view every day. Some people say they can write and work anywhere. I'm kind of hoping I can recoup that feeling out in the wild, something about being in nature, being able to get a bit of fresh air, get back to work, bit of fresh air, get back to work. Oh, noisy neighbour, I'll just move home.
So here's the thing. I'm actually a very sort of home-loving person on one side of my personality, and then on the other side of my personality, I'm a wanderer, I'm a gypsy. And the thing I really like about the boat is I've got the best of both worlds. I've got my home here, all my familiar things here, you know, my iPad, you know, my kitchen stuff, my bed, all that sort of stuff. I don't actually play the guitar. I just literally picked that up to stick on my wall in my listening room at home. A real pose, eh? But you've got you've got familiar objects around you. You've got your wardrobe full of clothes. You've got your bathroom that nobody else is using and stuff like that. So it's kind of like your home from home. And yet you do have, if you want, a totally different vista each day. Or you can do, as we've been doing this summer, rock up somewhere you like and stay there for 14 days. The rules are you can moor anywhere for 14 days as long as it's on the towpath side and doesn't have a sign telling you that you can't moor there for 14 days or you can't moor there at all. You will see some places where there's a 24-hour or even a 2-hour limit if it's like a shopping centre or something like that. But the rule is, on the towpath, in the middle of the countryside, you've got 14 days tied up to that spot before you have to move. It took me 4 months to get from Lincoln to Rugby this year. So that's slow boat.
So it's all about the journey. It's all about being in the moment when you're moving along. It's less about the destination.
I think one of the mistakes that new boaters and hire boaters make is they put a pin in a map and then they race to that point at 4 miles an hour. And, you know, they think, oh, I've got to get there, I've got to get there. Then the next day, I've got to get there. I think particularly if you've hired a boat, you feel you don't get value for money unless you do 200 miles during your fortnight. And I was like that at first. You know, I used to do these epic journeys like Lincoln to London in 2 weeks, which sounds like a long time until you try it. And actually, that's almost world record pace. But then you kind of slow down a bit and you start to stop in places and appreciate the places a little bit more and move very slowly and explore the local countryside or towns or villages or whatever. One of the things that my wife and I, deckhand and I, like to do is go and moor up in a town and go hit the charity shops. I'm generally looking for old vinyl. She may be looking for other things, furnishings or dresses or shoes or whatever. But one of the things we really like to buy from these charity shops is the ship's crockery, because inevitably it gets broken, particularly seeing as deckhand is clumsy. And so we buy all this like old china from charity shops. And in fact, if you look in the cupboards in the galley, which is the correct name for the kitchen, you will find this mishmash of sort of bone china. Vintage bone china. And we just really like that. You know, we really like that. You're meeting different people. You're hearing different accents. You're seeing different wildlife. You know, different places have different creatures. And it really is. It's like brain food all the time, all the time. I'm 100% addicted. I think the only thing which will tempt me off the canals is the sea.
Wow, that's aiming for the highest possible high. If you were Admiral of the Canal and River Trust, what would be the first thing you do?
Oh my God, that's a huge question. The Canal and River Trust is a denationalised industry. So it's obviously a massive, can I say, clusterfuck? It would need total reorganisation from the ground up. Now, I happen to know their chairman. I've met him several times at business conferences. He's a friend of somebody I've worked for. So I know that that's exactly what he will be trying to do because that's his speciality. But I think he probably needs 20 years to achieve that because British Waterways is very much like British Rail in many ways. Huge inefficiencies, overstaffing, etc., etc. What would I do? If I had a magic wand, I'm not sure I'd change an awful lot.
What about the Bedford branch?
Oh, I'd definitely build the Bedford branch. And I'd scrap HS2 and spend the money on the canals and broadband infrastructure because we don't need HS2. That's yesterday's way of getting around. Really, I think the future of work is not travelling. It's learning how to work from wherever you are and having the tools to do that. And I've proved that by being a... I'm not self-employed like you anymore. I'm not a freelancer. I work in a corporate environment, but I'm very fortunate to have a teleworking position and a manager who doesn't mind the fact that one day I'm in Rugby and the next day I'm in Limehouse.
So you Skype in, but how long before... I mean, if you have to Skype in, you'll Skype in or whatever unbranded conversational platform you might use, or open source, they are out there. You could be donning the goggles soon and appear in the office as a hologram.
Yes, indeed, I could. I could, and bring it
proving on. Proving the lack of need for HS2.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, this is the bizarre thing, of course. I work... My company's headquartered in Paris. My... office is nominally in Slough. I literally can't remember the last time I was in that office. And once they said to me, oh, you need to come into the office more, and I asked them to explain to me logically why I needed to come into the office more, and they really struggled. They said, oh, it's about mixing with your colleagues. And I said, well, none of them are there either, and we can just Skype. And I've been having these virtual relationships with people for many years. I mean, it's probably a decade since we last met physically, yet we've kept close all that time via these virtual methods of communication. Very close, actually, with some people, you know, without ever seeing them. I made very, very valuable relationships online with people that I've never met. And in fact, I was doing that before when I was a journalist, because I was an internationally syndicated journalist and I was working for editors that I'd never, ever met. So I don't actually agree that face-to-face is essential. Sometimes, but it's not essential.
You sell it every moment. I don't know if I could relinquish the house just yet, but the more I talk to you, the more I'm not getting too utopian about it. I know there's ups and downs. There's a notebook in front of me where you've been giving me some tips and tricks, which I'm going to keep to myself, actually, because some of these are absolute gold. And I think if somebody coming aboard, subject to survey, my future narrowboat will go, where the hell did you learn that trick? And I can say, from an old pirate friend of mine. Final tip from you for me then, because this is getting towards the end of the year. There may be stoppages, because by the time I think I can move the boat, it's going to be mid-November potentially. After talking to you now, I'm thinking I should just get on it, move it as far as I can. If I get stopped, find somewhere safe to leave it. Get back on it when I can, because it's a month to bring it to Cambridgeshire. Do you think that's the right thing for me to do, or should I just moor it there and leave it till the spring?
Bring it back, bit by bit, however you do it. Go round the stoppages, wait the backside of the stoppages, whatever it takes, bring it back. Actually, winter cruising has some massive challenges, but it also has huge rewards. Firstly, the canals are much less busy. There's no hire boaters, and you know, without wanting to offend hire voters, I was one myself. That's how, you know, one of the things that got me into this. There is a little bit of an us and them between those who own their boats and those who hire their boats. Some of it caused by the fact that, you know, if you're a hire boater, you obviously have a lower skill level, so you might bump people a bit more or break a few of the rules. But, you know, it'll be bliss. It'll be wonderful. You can leave your boat in safe places. There are various ways that you can leave your boat secure and safe and abandon it and go off to work or whatever. And by the time you get back, whenever that might be, midwinter, spring or whatever, you would have gone up such a steep learning curve that you will be close to expert pirate.
I'm up for that. Glenn, thanks very much. And I'm guessing that should we be on the waterways at the same time, which I really hope is going to happen, it won't be another 10 years until we catch up.
No, we need to get ourselves a convoy, Christian.
Cue music.
This is a download from Documentally. To find out more, go to documentally.com.
I think I'm gonna crash.